I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Throughout history, those who have worried most about putting too much faith in the military have been the generals themselves. President Dwight Eisenhower talked about the grave implications of the military-industrial complex. The potential for the disastrous rise of misplaced power exists, he warned. And that was more than 40 years ago. But go back further. General George Washington, even when he was endorsing the idea of a standing army, was quick to acknowledge that it hath ever been considered dangerous to the liberties of a country. So what do we make of a new pile of research which tells us that confidence in and support for the U.S. military is perhaps at one of its highest levels in history, and, at the same time, that confidence in politicians remains at near record lows? Connection listeners, does America's new faith in its soldiers mark a new militarism? Is this an eagerness to reach for the pistol before the pen? Or is this a long overdue nod of gratitude for those who do, those who are, even today, risking their lives? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Andy Bacevich is with me in the studio. He's the author of the book American Empire. He was a platoon leader in Vietnam and commander of the 11th Armored Cavalry in the First Gulf War. He's now a professor and director of the Center for International Relations at Boston University. Andy, welcome back to The Connection.
Thank you.
And we also have with us David King. He's an associate professor of public policy at Harvard, and his new book is called The Generation of Trust, How the U.S. Military Has Regained the Public's Confidence Since Vietnam. David, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Generation of Trust. Does that tell us something, that we're talking in large part about young people who are moving these numbers?
That's right. Generation has two meanings here. One, what is it that the military has done over the past 30 years to help create a better sense of trust by improved performance, better professionalism, and public persuasion? But it's had its greatest impact on the young. People's attitudes towards hierarchical and authoritarian institutions tend to be fixed in their mid to late teens. So somebody today who was born in the mid-1970s has their image of the military shaped around the first Gulf War and successes and wonderful movies. People born in the early to mid-1950s had their images of the war and of the military shaped by Vietnam, the Tet Offensive, mm-hmm. and those views have tended to stick with them. So that today, someone born in the early 1950s is far less likely to have confidence and trust in the military than someone born since the mid-1970s. The generation of trust really are those in high school and college and into their late 20s.
But you're also saying that having that respect for support of the military imprinted in the late teens means that it's likely to be with them for the rest of their lives.
That's right, just as it has been with the baby boomers. For the most part, people who were baby boomers and grew up and had their impressions made during the Vietnam era still don't trust the military. It's unlikely that they'll dramatically change. As with now the youngest generation, the millennials born since 75, they are likely, especially after this war where it has been a success, so the positive images of the military have really been imprinted and reinforced, it's unlikely that that's going to change dramatically.
You ticked off three things: performance, professionalism, and persuasion, as moves that the military has made, in your view, toward improving the image. Was it being done with an aim to improve the image, or was the military simply out to become more professional with a higher level of performance?
Well, the answer is both of them. However, the critical event was the disappearance of the draft and the rise of the all-volunteer force in 1974. And there was very little support, of course, coming out of Vietnam or the closing days of Vietnam for a draft that many mm-hmm. people had managed to evade. And in the mid-1970s, then, the military faced a terrible dilemma trying to get people attracted into the military. In 1978, for example, over half of the new recruits into the Marines did not have high school diplomas. Unthinkable today. Today we have the very best young men and women going into all branches of the armed forces.
College degrees more than high school diplomas, yeah.
So the military had to begin thinking of itself as a university would imagine itself. 1 year away from not being able to exist if you don't get the recruits that year. There was also a very serious internal look at how they had performed in the Vietnam War and a series of important reforms.
Publicly or how they'd fought the war?
It was how they fought the war. The important book by Harry Summers on strategy. It really changed much of thinking about war strategy. And then there was a reform in the 1980s that changed the structure of joint command.
Now, Andy Bacevich, when we look back at the contrast that David's outlining for us from that low level of support in the mid-1970s, which, you know, in our lives really was a low in everybody's regard for the military, to the high regard that the military is being held in today, are you inclined to want to stretch that out a little bit and look back a generation or 100 or 200 years to see this in a longer historical context?
Yes. I mean, phenomenon that David is describing, in a sense, it seems to me, is not surprising, particularly in that younger generation, because all this younger generation, in a sense, the post-Cold War generation, has known is success, quality, high level of performance. But the fact that this younger generation shows this unquestioning, almost infatuation with the military in the larger context is extraordinary and striking, because when we look at the full length of American history, as you were suggesting in your opening remarks, Dick, a skepticism of military institutions and a skepticism of military power has been a core principle of what makes us Americans, of our thinking as political actors and as citizens. And so now it seems that that's being washed away.
Let me ask you, though, to be a little bit more specific. When we talk about the skepticism of a standing army in a nation that freed itself from precisely that sort of monarchical militarism, that's not the same thing as the kind of turning up of the nose that soldiers face coming back from Vietnam. It wasn't skepticism in 1975. There was almost disdain.
No, it was
real public.
There was antipathy. There was disdain. Now, there's no question about that. And my sense is that in addition to the improved performance of the military in the last decade and a half or so, which is very real, that at least arguably, I couldn't provide data the way David does, another factor here is that those of us who are the baby boomer generation have, since Vietnam, continued to rethink Vietnam. Vietnam divided our generation. And those who were against the war, I mean, I fought in the war, but I mean, those who were against the war came to fasten a certain amount of blame for the war on the soldiers themselves, hence that disdain for mm-hmm. people who served. Well, that was a mistaken judgment at the time. I mean, the war was a mistake, but to blame soldiers at the time was a mistake. And I think as we have come to distance ourselves from the war, even those who opposed it have begun to rethink this particular expression of anti-militarism, which was an antipathy to the soldiers.
So the next time large forces of Americans went into the field in the first Gulf War, do you think the pendulum was all the way over
and
at the other side?
And that becomes the opportunity, in a sense, for those who opposed the war and whose opposition to the war was an expression, expressed itself in opposition to soldiers, to make good, to correct that, to say that, yes, these are our
right,
best.
Right.
These are our heroes.
And that's when this generation, David, first started paying attention to what the U.S. military was, the generation that you're talking about, who are impressed with, confident in, supportive of the military. I think, though, it's important for us to take those numbers and place them in context of the other numbers that see a continued drop in support for politicians, for institutions of government, Congress, even, you know, city council, and on up to the federal government, because it's that crossing that worries you. Am I right?
That's right. In fact, if we look internationally, we find across the globe in post-industrial sort of new economy countries, of which there are 34, 37 in that range, that confidence and trust in all sorts of public institutions and in the church and in universities, unfortunately, have been decreasing, especially among the youngest generation. And that certainly is the case with hierarchical authoritarian institutions, so that in these post-industrial countries, the Catholic Church, for example, has been hurt much more in public opinion than a Protestant church, which is not as hierarchical and authoritarian. But one of the most hierarchical and authoritarian institutions in the world is the U.S. military. Military institutions around the world have been falling in public esteem, with the great exception of the United States. So there's a dramatic growing gap between confidence in civil institutions and public institutions around the world and confidence in the United States and the U.S. military. What it means, that's something we can all speculate about. You can't have a functioning civil society with too little trust, and it's poisonous to have too much trust, because then our civil rights can easily be abused.
Are you seeing this, Andy, as a significant change in this country's thinking?
Well, it's tremendously significant in my judgment, and we can't make the case definitively, but it seems to me that this sort of data sort of fits into a larger mosaic, and that mosaic begins to look like, as you suggested again, American militarism. And this shift in attitudes on the part of this younger generation, which, as you suggest, David, could be a permanent shift, happens at the same time we have a political elite that is now rather enthusiastic about using American military power around the world to reshape the world, to embed our values in other societies. So a political elite that is comfortable with, if not enthusiastic about, the use of force, combined with citizens who are, in general, have little confidence in institutions other than the military, that could be a pretty dangerous mix in a democracy, it seems to me.
That's right. It's an interesting conundrum, though, for this current White House, because confidence in the White House is not increasing. And to the extent that this war was seen as George Bush's war, the public would not support it. To the extent that it was seen as the strength of the U.S. military, it worked for public opinion.
Connection listeners, our number is 1-800-423-8255. As we look at statistics which show a dramatic increase in support for and confidence in the U.S. military at the same time when that support and confidence is dropping for other institutions, are we watching the growth of American militarism? Do you see it that way? 1-800-423-TALK. Join us. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Many Baghdad residents are still waiting for food, gas, and other basic services in the wake of the Iraq War. For more on that and related stories, visit our website every day.
You're listening to The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. We're talking about new confidence, or new research showing American confidence in the military. And David King is with us. He's co-author of a new book called The Generation of Trust, How the U.S. Military Has Regained the Public's Confidence Since Vietnam. Andrew Basevich is also with us. He's a professor of international relations at Boston University, served 23 years in the U.S. Army, retiring as colonel. He's author of a book called American Empire. We're joined on the phone now by Scott Snook. Scott is associate professor of organizational behavior at the Harvard Business School, also a retired colonel in the U.S. Army. And Scott, tell me how you're looking at the numbers that David King's been crunching in his book. What do you think of this?
Yeah, I think it's perhaps useful to try to make a distinction. Obviously, I study organizations, and between the internal potential outcomes of this trend and the external outcomes. And clearly from an organizational perspective and performance standpoint, you can imagine a virtuous upward spiral that this will tend to kick off, the numbers that David's uncovered.
Why do you say virtuous?
Virtuous internally for the organization, because what happens is as the reputation in the military goes up, and in particularly in the target population for recruiting younger folks, you're able to attract, select, and retain high-quality people that are required for the new Army, which is a very different set of requirements, and given the autonomy and the high technology and the high information and knowledge requirements. And then that sets off a virtuous spiral when you combine that with the investments in technology, you combine that with the additional resources and the autonomy, and then increased performance and continuing increased performance in different battlefields, that continues to feed into this reputational upward spiral. So from an internal perspective, when you study organizations, this type of reputational effect in the broader society can feed these type of positive spirals.
Now, what about the external outcome?
Yeah.
What about the mix of this with democracy?
Right. And then the concern, of course, is on the opposite side of the civil-military relations divide, the potential downside, some of which you mentioned, but a couple that haven't been mentioned are the potential identity crisis that we've really been dealing with the last decade in particular, which follows from a potential overuse and misuse, very seductive. When you have a great hammer, everything looks like a nail. And the more successful you are across the broad range of spectrum, from peacekeeping to nation building to drug enforcement to high intensity conflict, you'll tend to overuse that great tool. That can lead to an identity crisis, which we did experience in the past decade. We largely used to attract, select, and retain warriors. And then we found that in the last 10, 15 years, all we've been doing since 1989 is mostly peacekeeping and nation building. And then, of course, the overuse can lead to some of the challenges on retention and high operations.
Scott, tell me, though, how this balances out in your mind, higher expectations, perhaps the higher standards in the military as a result of this against the way that it is seen, the way that it is perceived. Are you saying that this level of confidence is not a bad thing?
I think it's a wonderful thing inside the military, and you're going to build up a great organization. I think the real place, the battlefield, the place to focus is on the civil-military divide and to avoid the overuse and misuse. And I'm very confident, if you look at the dynamic inside the Pentagon, the real governor, I think, you see here, and witness retired General Powell as a great example, personal example, I think the real governor on the overuse, misuse, and expansion of the potential downsides that I mentioned will, in fact, be senior uniformed military officers.
All right, Scott, thanks for your time.
You're welcome.
Scott Snook, Associate Professor of Organizational Behavior at the Harvard Business School. And Andy, you share similar history. Do you think that the restraint will be there from within the institutions of the military?
Yes, but. And the but is that the military doesn't call the shots and should not call the shots with regard to how the military is employed. I mean, the principle of civilian control is one that needs to be respected. And there's at least a certain amount of anecdotal evidence in the current administration that, I'm not defending the current administration by a long shot, that the civilian leadership is willing to basically hammer the generals until the generals do what the civilian leadership wants. Mr. Rumsfeld, I think, in particular, is reported to be rather firm on this. So that governor of reluctant warriors may not be as effective as Professor Snook was speculating.
And David, just before we go to calls, then help me understand how we draw a clear black line between diminishing respect for the politicians and rising respect for the military if, as Andy rightly points out, the ultimate command and control of the military is meant to come from the president, the politician, the civilian. Now, how do you separate them then?
Well, it's very difficult, and it'll take the American public trying to help their politicians separate that. programs like this and a better sense of history would also help. But Andrew Snoke is exactly correct that we have a fabulous hammer. Not only do we want to, for the most part, use it unilaterally as opposed to multilaterally, which is how most of our international problems have to be solved, but it's been a wonderful organization to help solve other problems. The military and drugs. The drugs are virtually absent from the military now. It's been a fabulous source of racial integration in the promotion of minorities. Women in the military since the early 1980s have, for the most part, been a showcase for how to.
So the social modeling that the military provides for the rest.
But that's scene one of social modeling. Scene two of social modeling are now the plethora of proposals in Congress to use the military model as and the military itself as a form of civic service, right. Volunteerism, and. A new Peace Corps through the military. And when that happens, if it happens, the notion of having a lot of warriors controlling the governor, making sure we don't move too far into this, is going to be a little bit passé.
Andy, quick point before we go to the call?
Very briefly, one needs to be a little bit skeptical, I think, about the military as social model. I mean, I think I probably agree with about 95% of what David said on that line, but I was struck during the most recent Gulf War, for example, that on the one hand, we have the narrative of the story that says our best and the brightest are out there doing great things, and they were. And there's a second story that managed never to intersect, and the second story was this unfolding sex scandal at the Air Force Academy, clearly an institution which has major problems relating to the abuse of women. Well, that's the same institution that produces the great fighter pilots. The military has done many good things with regard to drugs and race and so on. But if you look at the details, these guys got their own warts that should make us a little bit wary of saying somehow the rest of American society should follow in the military's footsteps.
I just have one quick comment on that in terms of the public opinion data. We don't have the data for the Air Force, but we do for Aberdeen Proving Grounds and for Tail Hook. In the wake of those, which were truly deplorable scandals and behavior, American mothers surveyed said that they were actually encouraged by the results in that these things came to light and people were very severely punished. That's what's going to happen in Colorado as well. But, certainly being a woman in the military is not an easy task. But being a woman surviving in the male-oriented business world is also no cakewalk.
1-800-423-8255. Let's go first to Richard, joining us now from Louisville, Kentucky. Hi, Richard.
Hi. I'm one of those baby boomers who is very active in protesting the war in Vietnam. But I'm not at all surprised at these polls because it seems to me that even then there was considerable support for the troops themselves. I never saw this disdain for the soldiers. I think that's quite a gross exaggeration. In fact, people have almost always supported the troops, even if they don't support the policy or the politicians who advocate it.
Andy, you came back wearing a uniform. Talk to Richard about this.
I would never question Richard's recollection and his own feelings, but, boy, I would tell you that for those of us who served at the time, maybe we were especially sensitive. I don't know. But and I'm not going to give any stories anybody ever spit on me or anything. But I know that my generation of soldiers came home from that war with a sense of being alienated, a feeling that we were looked upon as something of an embarrassment and
not respected for the time that
and
you spent there.
Absolutely. And quite frankly, were deeply wounded in ways that did not heal overnight. Now, all this is, up in our psyche more than anything else. But I got to tell you, it was a widespread feeling among those in the officer corps at the time. I am certain of that.
Richard.
And I wouldn't argue with his feelings either. It's just my experience was that among those who were most opposed to the war, that one of the reasons was to support the soldiers, to support the troops. And while what he sensed was undoubtedly there, because I hear it all the time also, it was not coming from those who had principled objections.
Isn't it interesting, Richard, that 30 years later, the same argument came up around the Iraq War? How could you be against this war and support the troops, or how could you support the troops and not support the president? You know, the circle that people got caught up in there. So I suspect that part of it is always going to be with us. Thanks for your call. Next to Fairfax, South Carolina, Martin's on the line. Hi, Martin.
Good morning.
Thanks for calling.
Good morning.
Yeah, go ahead.
And I just like to just start off by sending greetings to Skip Basevich, who was my commander in the Persian Gulf.
Was he any good, by the way?
he definitely knew where he wanted the ship to go. Yes, good morning. My comment is that the Army, I believe, has, I speak for the Army, has done a definitely great job in the time since Vietnam of marketing itself very well as opportunity for young people. And I think today the attitude on the part of young people towards the military is one is much, much different than when I went to school back during the Vietnam era.
But, Martin, is that a marketing campaign or is it a markedly different product, if we want to talk about it in those terms?
No, it's definitely also internal. The lack of tolerance, for example, for drug abuse, the standards that have been set in terms of performance, physical and discipline and otherwise, the Army did a great job for lack of a better term, cleaning itself up after the Vietnam era. And
So the Army earned the confidence.
I think so. Yeah, very definitely.
David, is that what your numbers indicate? I mean, part of this, which we did, I don't want to go too far into the figures because they're kind of hard to follow on radio, but you make that comparison of 1975 to 2002, and I'm wondering whether or not it was a slow and steady curve or whether or not things sort of jumped up remarkably after September 11th. Was that a significant turning point?
September 11th was important, certainly for the youngest Americans, but the trend has been gradual and ongoing.
Right.
It did spike with the first Gulf War. And I want to spend just a moment talking about the marketing, because the marketing by the Pentagon has been exceptionally well done. It's not just the obvious campaigns such as Be All You Can Be or now An Army of One. It's a new, highly sought-after video game called An American Soldier, which was subsidized.
Is this the thing on the Internet?
That's correct.
So what does the Army have to... Oh, sorry.
Subsidized and produced by the Pentagon.
Oh, I didn't know that.
The Television and Film Liaison Board provides military equipment and actually approves scripts. If in order to use military equipment, your script has to be approved. Includes, for example, a large subsidy to the production of Black Hawk Down, The Sum of All Fears, Behind Enemy Lines, Pearl Harbor, Perfect Storm, Armageddon, Air Force One. And then there are a series of films that were not approved and then cost more to produce because they did not put together the image that the military wanted, such as Space Cowboys or The Thin Red Line, G.I. Jane, Broken Arrow, Independence Day, Crimson Tide, Forrest Gump. So the marketing by the Pentagon has been very cleverly and wisely done. And it's also interesting that non-competitive political institutions such as Congress or the White House can't have that kind of marketing, because you run for Congress by running against the institution. You run for president by running against the person who already has that seat. And public institutions that can advertise and market effectively tend to be trusted better. One great example.
But let me stop you. I mean, politicians do get to spend money telling people how wonderful they are.
Mm-hmm.
And they spend a lot of that money telling people how wonderful they are. But it's the part of it's the oppositional part that interests me here, because you can criticize a politician, and that's your job if you're a politician in the other party. You're saying that there is no such alternate voice to the military, or hasn't been since 1968, 69?
Well, there always has been. Certainly the media and so forth will find ways of criticizing the media, of criticizing
military,
the military,
right.
and that makes a lot of sense. But there isn't as much competition. When one looks, for example, at confidence in there are two other institutions of the government where confidence has increased over the last 20 years quite dramatically. One is the Forest Service. The other is the U.S. Postal Service. So you have the military and two other uniformed agencies. I don't think it's just that they wear uniforms, but you have Smokey the Bear. And after Smokey the Bear advertisements air, one finds greater confidence in the Forest Service. And in the days after the Postal Service ran an ad for an overnight or two-day shipping service, £2, 2 days, $2, where a beautiful woman in a blue dress was holding up a package, confidence and trust in the Postal Service skyrocketed. The marketing and public persuasion are all part of the same story. Now, people wouldn't trust the Postal Service if their mail actually didn't get there on time, and people wouldn't trust the military if they weren't handling things professionally and winning conflicts.
Are the soldiers inside aware of what David's describing here? I mean, this whole notion of subsidizing some movies and not others, I'm going, oh, my God, I saw that movie. I didn't realize that it was... propaganda.
I don't know if the soldiers were. But I mean, the issue here, it seems to me, one of the issues here is this, I mean, back to the got a great hammer, everything looks like a nail. I don't think anybody would argue that we should do something to damage this great hammer. The real issue is, at least an interesting question would be, why is there so little interest in Washington or among our fellow citizens in trying to develop some other hammers? You know, the State Department is, I think, by common consent, a broken institution. But perhaps because they can't market themselves, there's really very little interest in people saying, you know, we ought to spend some money and some energy and fix American diplomacy. In the general American attitude about development is it's throwing money down a black hole. Well, maybe we ought to develop some tools and some methods to do that more effectively abroad so that the biggest hammer of all could be used less frequently.
Connection listeners, what is the risk that there'll only be one tool in the toolbox? 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Landry & Arcari Oriental Rugs and Carpeting of Salem and Boston, displaying their collections for...
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. And we're talking this hour about... David King's research indicating a dramatic increase in support for the U.S. military at a time when public support for other institutions is dropping fairly dramatically. David's here in the studio with me, as is Andrew Basevich. He's the author of the book called American Empire, The Realities and Consequences of U.S. Diplomacy. And he's also a professor of international relations at Boston University. So a little bit from the professor here on the worry, the concern that you were talking about earlier in the program, Andy, that this, where this leads the country. Are there examples in recent history that are instructive?
Well, there are. I mean, I guess the basic point I would say is that the founders, the concern that the founders had about the incompatibility of military power with republican government, with constitutional governments, was founded in their understanding of history. And there have been episodes in our own time, or virtually in our own time, which would seem to suggest that the founders were onto something. And I mean, I would cite the examples of 20th century Germany and Japan. And I would not cite them for a second to suggest that we are like the Weimar Germany,
yeah.
Or that we are like Japan in the 1930s. But those were two nations that did have some reasonable form of constitutional government. And in part, at least, as a result of their infatuation with military power, it all came crashing down with horrific implications for the people of those nations and for the rest of us as well.
But did it collapse because at the same time there was a growing respect for confidence in the military? People had less confidence in the other options that politicians had. Was it an inclination to choose a military solution first?
And It was that. Again, I'm not trying to argue that. I would not want to argue for a second that we should not respect Americans who wear uniforms. It is this convergence of this unquestioning support for the military, a convergence of that with the fact that we now have a political class that is, as I suggested before, I think too eager to use military power. It's that which then suggests, at least to someone like myself, that we're moving down a path that begins to look, smell, smack of something like an American version of militarism, and we should, as citizens, all be very conscious of that. If that's the path we're going to go down, then let's do it consciously. Let's understand the risks that are entailed, and let's understand that that marks a radical departure from what the founders intended back in the aftermath of the Revolutionary War, when this constitutional republic came into existence.
And David, are we getting at any of that in the type of feedback you're hearing from the public, and acknowledgement that this matters, that this means something more than just yeah, I like them and I don't like them?
Well, certainly it does. If you have confidence in one institution and not in the other, you're going to overuse the one that you trust. Mm-hmm. And that's the basic problem. There may, in the long term here, be something of a fix. While it certainly seems to be the case that attitudes towards institutions, hierarchical, authoritarian institutions, tend to be fixed in the teens, one also sees that children rebel against their parents. You know, the baby boomers were that, like that old show, Family Ties, where they couldn't believe that their son, Alex Keaton, was wearing a suit and tie and liking Ronald Reagan. Some of the support that young people have for the military is actually a reaction against their parents. And one would expect a similar backlash against the children of the millennials 10, 15 years from now.
No, I remember
it won't be cool.
I remember a fascinating piece that I read a couple of months ago in the newspaper about professors at universities being inclined to criticize the idea of a war in Iraq at the same time as their students were saying, what are you talking about? This is a good idea.
That's right.
Just seemed like such a reverse from the 1960s. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. Let's go to Chapel Hill, North Carolina, and Mark's joining us. Hi, Mark.
Hello. How are you?
Fine. Thanks for calling.
Good. My question related to a general issue that I was hoping you could discuss. And that is that in contrast to the wars in the Gulf, which have been very short and sweet, the Vietnam War was a long, drawn-out affair. And most significantly, in contrast to those wars in the Gulf, it entailed a mass draft. And I think that that mass draft, where citizens from around the whole United States were asked to see their sons and daughters go and, or I should say sons, not daughters, mm-hmm. but sons go and fight in a war that they might not necessarily have agreed with, of necessity stirred up the mud much more than if you had kids who were volunteers going to war.
Let me just ask you a couple of quick questions, if I might, Mark. First of all, on the length of the war, mm-hmm. You probably saw, as I did yesterday, reports that another four American soldiers were killed in Iraq,
sure.
at a time when people are wondering, gosh, is the Army, you know, reorganizing itself? Is this thing even close to being over? So fair to say that it's a little early to judge on that one?
Sure, yeah.
And the second one is, after 9/11... if American mothers and fathers were told that, you know, we need more soldiers and we're going to reinstitute conscription for a short period of time, do you think the country would have been any more willing to say it's the right thing to do? Or do you think that the experience of Vietnam was such that that'll never work again?
I think that the experience of Vietnam was such that it would be very hard to do that again. And I really feel that. I also sense, from my perspective, but I know from millions of others as well, that there's a fear that 9/11 is being used as an excuse, as a whipping post for going in various imperialist adventures around the world. And in this sense, the abuse of 9/11 is something we have to think about, too. That was a very tragic event, but are we, in fact, using it as an excuse to go to war, rather than something that that should be both respected for what it was and sort of make us think a little bit more about our policies overseas and the effect of our policies.
I wonder if I can, Mark, turn to Andy just on the issue of the draft and whether or not that's something that we need to distinguish between in Vietnam and today.
I think that's dead on. And David will have the data. I just got sort of anecdotal evidence, and that is that this is support for a professional military. That is to say, this is the young American supporting an institution which he or she will probably not have anything to do with, even in the aftermath of 9/11.
But knows that there are people in there who are career soldiers.
And they take care of that dirty work. Even after 9/11, because I queried my students here at Boston University in my classes, okay, who is willing to sign up? Well, not me. What would you think of the government reinstituting the draft? Absolute opposition.
Huh.
So we're comfortable with this military, but we're comfortable with a military where it's other people who actually go serve and sacrifice. I see very little support for even the idea of conscription.
Yeah, that's exactly right. That's what the data bear out. We did a national survey of 1,200 college students, and 72% in the wake of 9/11, 72% very strongly opposed the reinstitution of the draft, supported the military, but for the most part weren't willing to serve themselves. Now, that's not really a problem in that the military has plenty of wonderful recruits and they're hitting their numbers without any trouble at all.
Well, my understanding, they're hitting their numbers. There's no question about that.
Hitting their numbers means they're getting the people that they want.
Their annual quota, which they got to
yes.
hit if they're going to keep this force alive. But my sense is that they hit that number as a result of enormous exertions. I saw a newspaper report, it's now a couple of years old, I think we're spending $11,000 for every soldier that we recruit. So it's not as if these kids are coming storming into the recruiting office. We have to be out there, you know, encouraging them.
Well, post 9/11, it's been considerably easier to encourage them to come. And on all the standardized tests, these are the highest quality recruits in the history of standardized tests in the military. You have to be a college graduate, high school graduate to get into the military. And the so-called Category C is virtually empty now.
I want to see if I can put a sort of real-time, real event understanding to the study that you've done, David. When President Bush says it's time for a war on terror, and the country goes, well, we just watched the buildings come down, it's got to be time for something. And when President Bush says it's time for an attack on Saddam Hussein's regime, are we right to measure support for the military in the lack of opposition to the president? When the nation goes, proper thing. Is that what we're talking about here in terms of trusting the military, in terms of saying, let's let the people in uniform do the job?
Well, it's hard. There's always a rally around the flag effect on the eve of war and in the wake of a tragedy. People had dramatically higher confidence in the federal government the week after 9/11, even though 9/11 was a terrible failure by the federal government. So one has to be quite skeptical about the data that one finds mm-hmm. on confidence and trust just before and after a conflict.
Okay.
So that's why the book looks at data, yearly data since 1973 through 2002, and we can assess these long-term trends. Now, to the extent that young people had confidence and trust in the military based only on what they were seeing on television and hearing on the radio and by the fatigues that they were wearing to upset their parents and so forth, it probably wasn't very deep. But what's happened with the war in Iraq is that it's very likely solidified their predispositions, their tendency to have a positive view of the military has now been solidified by experience. Had the second Gulf War gone very badly, I think we'd be talking about a different story today.
But that's where it seems to me your comment to Mark is relevant. I mean, I also have been struck by the extent to which the victory in Iraq is beginning to look be less complete than we first thought. And I wouldn't pretend to try to forecast events, but if one would imagine that a year from now we still have American soldiers being ambushed and this sort of slow, steady reporting of casualties in a situation that politically appears to be still unstable, some of this, some of the confidence in the hammer could potentially be diminished.
The most likely the confidence will be diminished in the presidency and in the civilian control over the military, but not the military itself.
Okay.
Unless, by the way, the military begins behaving badly, and we haven't seen any hint of that yet.
Andy, you were a soldier for 23 years, and you're the one saying that we should worry about putting too much confidence in the military. In a nutshell, aren't you arguing against what you did for 23 years?
Well, in my mind, no. Of course, I'm a Vietnam generation Cold War soldier.
But you want me, you want people to be skeptical of people like you in uniform.
No. I don't want you to be skeptical of the people in uniform. I want you to be skeptical about military power. I want you to ask why it is we live in a country in which there is almost unthinking support for military power and military institutions, and no commensurate concern about why other institutions look poorly by comparison, no commensurate concern about why other instruments of power are not also effective. I want you to think about whether or not we are drifting towards a new American militarism that I believe is dangerous.
Thanks so much for coming in. Andy Bacevich is a professor of international relations at Boston University and author of American Empire. David King, thanks so much for being here. David's associate professor of public policy at Harvard and author of a new book. It's called The Generation of Trust, How the U.S. Military Has Regained the Public's Confidence Since Vietnam. And earlier in the program, we chatted with Scott Snook. He's an associate professor of organizational behavior at the Harvard Business School. Our senior producer is Tara Murphy. My name's Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.
This is WBUR. Hour two of The Connection is coming up next. Conflict in Character, George W. Bush. We're funded by you, our listeners, also by Corey McPherson Nash, a design firm developing branding, printing, and interactive solutions, celebrating 20 years in the business, cmndesign.com. Creative Catering in Somerville, providing distinctive food for any event. Catering menus are available at 6-